You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show. Hour two here on this Monday, July 11th. If you want to be on the program, give us a call, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text or email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or post your thought or question on Facebook or on Twitter. If you've got a question or a comment for my guest who's just fresh in the studio, Father Tom Galloway. Father Tom, who is an Orthodox priest, he's the pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church here in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from, Antiochian Orthodox, and it comes on once a month. And so I've said, Father Tom, you've got a, you know, you hear about people having a face made for radio. That's my jurisdiction. But you have a voice made for radio. If you hadn't, you know, this whole priesthood thing hadn't been a thing, you know, maybe in another life.
Perhaps. It's a wonderful compliment. Thank you very much. I don't know that I do have a voice per se for radio, but
or maybe you could have been a Pirates play-by-play guy. You're wearing your Pirates T-shirt today.
Always, I'm a diehard Bucco fan.
And I hadn't been paying. I know they had been struggling a little bit, but as you pointed out, they've sort of charged here. At the All-Star break, they are in third, though, looking at the standings. A half game behind the Cardinals, 7.5 behind the Cubs, who are faltering now.
Well, no one is invincible in this world. The true test of a baseball fan is whether or not you, I think, root for a team regardless. That's truly a fan. You remember the great years. You cherish the true stars. And you stay with them, thick or thin. Pirates fans are among the greatest baseball fans. We have achieved such notoriety internationally. For 20 straight years, we had losing seasons unparalleled in any professional sport anywhere in the globe. So, and the many firsts of the Pirates' history, that's one of our more dubious honors, shall we say. You know, the Pirates, in fact, the owner of the Pirates at the early 20th century helped invent the World Series and played in the first World Series. So there's a great deep tradition in history in the city of Pittsburgh. Some would say almost sometimes a love-hate relationship with the Pirates. There was a song out a few years ago. You may be able to find it yet online because nothing dies on the Internet. Which is called Pittsburgh, the City of Champions and the Pirates. And it's a marvelous little rap tune about the city of Pittsburgh, which is celebrating, of course, the Stanley Cup championship this year.
They'll go Penguins.
In the sport of hockey. So,
well, if there are people out there and you haven't driven through Pittsburgh lately, and you know you may not live in that part of the country or whatever, it is. It will dispel every false notion you have about what you think of Rust Belt and all the rest. It's a gorgeous city. That drive through, it's spectacular. So,
yeah,
beautiful. Anyway,
well, I miss the Mills.
Right,
I miss the Mills, and so do the people there. When the Mills were gone, there's a great sense of identity mm-hmm. for the city of Pittsburgh that was built by. That entire segment of life, whether it be the mills, the trucking firms, the railroads, the coal mines, that helped formulate much of the mind and the character of the region. And it's been a very befuddling and lost experience without that. And economic downturns, depopulation, all happened to every town there. So,
wow. Well, that's an interesting perspective. I hadn't thought of it in those terms. if you've got a question or a comment for Father Tom, 573-4-BREAD-4. We'd love to hear from you. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Father Tom, before we met, or after we met, the last time in between, there's this great council that was being called together of the 14, am I saying this right, autocephalous churches in the Orthodox community. Mm-hmm. They were coming together. It was seen as, in a sense, the Orthodox Vatican II.
That's what they were aiming at.
But there was already rumblings when we had you on the show last time about, I think it was the Bulgarians who weren't going to come, and some others ended up, what, 4 out of the 14 did not send representatives to the council.
And others had troubles getting delegations, yes.
So can you give us, maybe from your perspective, what happened at this council, what are the fruits that may come from it, or what are perhaps some of the issues, the divisions that were highlighted?
Well, this council had great hopes. In fact, there was a whole process that began. There was aspirations, late 20s, because it was things left on a table from a synod meeting of many Orthodox churches, not all, in the 1923. Since the 30s, people were looking for having a general council. And it was a dream, especially during the Iron Curtain days, that all the churches could come together. You know, sometimes we don't realize how secular politics interferes with, well, why you just let the church get together? Well, they couldn't for decades, you know, because of governmental interferences. Mm.
So people talk about, you know, you hear the phrase a lot, the separation of church and state. People oftentimes forget that usually the bigger problem is not the church interfering in the state, but vice versa.
Oh, definitely. And it is to this day, and in many, many instances in the Orthodox world, it still is a catastrophic problem of interference of government sometimes into the church life. In 1961, an ecumenical patriarch that some of your listeners may have known, Athenagoras I, who at one time had been an archbishop here in the United States. In fact, who helped ensure his election and get him there, Harry Truman flew him from the United States to Istanbul on Air Force One.
Really?
That's a true story. You can look that up. Athenagoras I was a great mind, a great visionary, and someone who sincerely wanted to have Christian unity. It was Athenagoras I that, for instance, began thawing out the schism between East and West. He had met...
Which dates back to 1054 AD.
In fact, in 1964, 1965, he had very publicly meetings with Pope Paul VI. In fact, at one point, they had gone and they met in Jerusalem. And it was almost a coming of the apocalypse. The people said, you know, that the meeting of the two churches together there. It was Athenagoras I that he and the Pope that time walked the Via Dolorosa together.
The way of suffering, the way of our Lord,
Jerusalem. They walked it together. And they were the ones, it was Athenagoras I that removed, that was the bull of excommunications, the mutual bulls of excommunications were removed and dropped by the two churches. Therefore, clearing the way for a very meaningful and purposeful dialogue between the two churches. In 1961, Patriarch Athenagoras envisioned making a great council a reality. And he wanted the church to be able to come together fully as the church. He wanted us to be able to address both pressing issues and internal issues that were left on the table from earlier meetings. How to address many issues of the modern world and our response to them. And, you know, our historical experience is similar but not the same as the West, particularly dealing with, at that time, communism, socialism, and many other shall we say, illnesses of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And he really wanted to have perhaps not exactly a Vatican II, but something of that scale that would address the needs and bring the church very squarely in people's lives towards the issues of the day. He wanted the church to come together. He wanted us to be able to discuss. He wanted us to produce documents and a mutual understanding between the churches that we could commonly held because we have commonly come to, you know, come together on
mm-hmm.
and jointly make resolutions. Process began and conciliar small sort of building up meetings had begun to happen, whether it be in Crete, whether it be in Chambassy, the ecumenical center, the Orthodox ecumenical center in Switzerland. These things have been building for years, consultations in Romania that would help produce this council. Well, in the interim.
So Rome's not the only place where things move slowly.
Well, a lot of progress was made and a lot of impact on the church just by having this process. It began to, the hope, especially with the collapse of the Iron Curtain, that would be even greater.
We'll pick this up on the other side of the break here in just a minute with Father Tom Galloway, pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church here in Lexington, Kentucky. Give us a call, 573-4BREAD-4. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show on this Monday, July 11th. We've got a comment or a question here with my friend Father Tom Galloway, who is an Orthodox Christian priest, pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church in Lexington, Kentucky. You got a comment or a question, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Father Tom, we're asking a question. Yesterday for the liturgy for Catholics in the Mass, the gospel reading was the parable of the Good Samaritan. One of several readings that, interestingly enough, very timely given the divisions in our country right now and the tension issues related to really reconciliation and that Christ reconciled all things to himself through the blood of the cross. But the Good Samaritan parable, a very interesting one that our Lord tells, because it whole flips on its head this idea of who's my neighbor and makes who the Jews would have seen as vilified, the hero of the story. And so my question is, if Jesus came today and gave that same parable in Dallas or in Baton Rouge or Orlando or some other places, how might the details be different?
I don't think people would hear him.
Hmm.
I don't think people would hear the point. What happened in Orlando was something which was a catastrophic. It was surely an act of terrorism. I hear people talk about tragedy. Well, it's tragic for the individuals, but this was a preventable. This wasn't something that was just out of nowhere that was, in that respect, tragic. It was tragic for those who were the victims of it.
Sure.
And I guess one of the things that I found saddest coming away from the coverage of that event and the international reaction it was a gay act. It wasn't an act against either humanity or secondly, against this country. The flags that were flying were not the flag. Actually, you know, that's what was being held up. Listen, whether someone is gay or not gay, they're an American. And this was an act really to be against the American way of life, even against free choice, against the things that this country stands for. And I guess that's one of the things I found about people became too wrapped up in their own cause to see the big picture or to understand that any act like this, and you heard very little in this vein, was really an act against humanity.
It's almost as if, and I think this is true in Orlando, I think it's also true in Dallas and everywhere else, it's almost like our grief has even become divisive now as a country.
Exactly. You know, in Dallas, this is horrific. Again, another preventable. This was premeditated.
Yeah, evidently for months is what I've been reading
this,
about.
Apparently, this just became the opportunity.
Right.
Okay. And here you have now five police officers who were killed. You have others who were wounded. I understand that one of them had just been married a couple weeks ago. One of them was like in his last week on the job, you know, something like that, that was shot. You hear these stories, and there's where the real tragedy and the depth of the sin begins to end up. When you put a face on it and see the consequences of actions. But again, it's like, well, you hear an almost hesitation in some of the reporting that somehow doesn't equate the crimes that's been done against one segment of society. It's almost, not saying it quite out loud, justified. No, it's not. You know, poverty has never been an excuse for criminality in the light of the gospel. I don't think that there is an excuse in the light of the gospel for acts of violence of this nature, because really you're taking innocent lives. There was nothing personal between these officers and that shooter. There was, you know, it wasn't an act of vengeance in that respect. So I think the depth of the sin and the selfishness, even regardless in our grief and in our now identities, no longer seeing ourselves as fellow citizens, is really reflected in this. These types of events.
And we look at, you know, as our pastor was talking about yesterday, you know, who is going to reconcile us? It's not going to be our political leaders. I mean, they're not going to be the ones who are able to reconcile us. You look at the two candidates we have in our major parties nominated for president. I wouldn't see either of those as reconciling figures, you know.
No, I think they have become, both of them, much maligned. I don't know either of them personally. I don't know if anyone listening does either. But they have become the tips of the spear in this regard, that they symbolize the divisiveness, the anger, the rage, the polarized opinions of this country. Now, the one of them, quite frankly, are very representative, I think, of the true generous heart of Americans. Nor do I think they really could really, either one of them, stand and say they speak as the leader of a united country. So here we are. It's a great example of living and trying to make choices in the fallen world.
Exactly. Well, you lived during, I mean, you know, you're a very young man, of course, but the late 60s, you know, 1968 and on forward, where things were, you had the Kent State shootings in 1970. How would you compare what's going on now to the national atmosphere then?
Well, okay, this is going to maybe speak to my ear. I think that there was some deeply fresh and meaningful questions being asked then. Okay. I think that it put into motion a kind of a strange system that we're always going to push the envelope. Whatever's there, we're going to somehow assault. into motion. And we're never going to be satisfied with any achievement, any law, any social change. We're going to keep doing it. And we're going to change and we're going to do things just because we can and because that's what we're going to do. That was set into motion then. I thought there was some good content. And the catalyst, probably back then, was more than anything else, of course, the Vietnam War. It helped to develop a catalyst for, well, just about everything there was. I mean, you know, between the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, it seemed to energize. Feminism came from there. In its more militant form, began to grow through the 70s, but its roots are there. The gay liberation movement, trying to liberate themselves in a society, started then. So many of the things in which now are full-blown in our society, gone mainstream, were all kind of catalysts from there. We had, in the 60s, there was a cultural revolution in China. And I think that without us really stating it quite this way, we had a cultural revolution. The values, the issues were all brought up in the 60s, and they began in kind of in a mellower form, became crystallized and became more and more reality in our laws, in our customs, in our, grew through the 70s. And, you know, it's like everything. Some were good, some were not.
Right.
How do you know which one's which? Well, I think you can judge them by their fruits. And much of the social change obviously had to happen. The idea that someone couldn't sit at a lunch counter because of the color of their skin, well, sounds almost absurd today.
Right.
The treatment of many segments of our society then. But, you know, prejudice wasn't simply discovered in between the 50s and 60s. We've had them in our societies from the very beginning. Your listeners will not be able to relate to the understanding that there were signs all over America that said, help wanted, no Irish need apply. That, you know, bigotry, people in the 1830s, into the 1830s, were so afraid, politicians were afraid they would find out that they had a Catholic in their family heritage, and they had to several generations back off farther and farther and farther, you know, to somehow hide that fact. Bigotry has been around, and it has to be confronted when it rears its head.
Well, I mean, the unity, even you could say democracy, is a fragile thing. I mean, every generation has to preserve it. We have this heritage that's been given to us, but it's...
Yeah, and I think that's one of the most unfortunate things, because this is going to be my criticism of education, that people really are not told the whole story.
Right.
Their information is manipulated. I just watched this special
We'll have to pick this up on the other side of the break. We're about to the end here. If you want to call with a comment for Father Tom Galloway, my guest, 573-4BREAD-4. We'll be back on the Mike Allen Show here in just a minute. This is Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We'll be right back.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show. Got a comment or a question? Can ask it a question of the day. If Jesus were to tell the Good Samaritan parable today in Orlando, Baton Rouge, Dallas, how might the details be different? If you want to speculate on that, 573-4-BREAD-4, you can call. Or if you've got a question for my guest, Father Tom Galloway, Orthodox priest, pastor of St. Andrew's Orthodox Church here in Lexington, Kentucky, 573-4-BREAD-4. Call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post your response on Facebook or on Twitter. So, Father Tom, back to the Pan-Orthodox Council that was seeking to be held there in Crete, I believe it was.
Yes, it was. It was moved.
And we talk about how to, some who called it, in a sense, as is anything, I'm sure, a caricature, but sort of the Orthodox Vatican II. And the idea of Vatican II was engaging with the modern world, that the church has to be more than simply an enclave or circle the wagons to preserve itself. It also has to engage evangelistically and to see where God's grace is at work in the world, to engage it there, to be a prophetic voice where it needs to be, and so forth. Do you think there is and maybe this is from our Western perspective, where Orthodoxy is really, relatively speaking, rather small in the Western world because of historical factors and all those, the rest, can there be a tendency for Orthodox Christians in the West to be prone to an enclave sort of mentality and not engaging the modern world?
No, I can say that it's not that they're not engaging. I think that people react differently. First of all, anyone who comes from an immigrant background reacts to things in the culture they come into differently. You want to express yourself to be very American. Okay, this was particularly the majority of us as they came up to, not the more recent arrivals off a plane, but I'm talking about just historically when the large numbers of immigrants came in. You wanted to express yourself to be an American. Yes, you wanted maybe to hold on to your own heritage, but on the other hand, you wanted to somehow, it had to be controlled. Have you ever saw the movie Deer Hunter? I use that a lot. It's okay. It dealt with a little bit about Russian Americans, people of Slavic ancestry, Orthodox. Many of them were Orthodox in the movie. And it should, when one of them is a patient in a hospital in Vietnam. Okay, it's got a Vietnam side to the movie. One of the doctors comes by and says, is this name Russian? And he looks at him and says, it's American. You know, kind of the question, what kind of name is that? Well, it's an American name.
Mm-hmm.
I relate to that movie. It was filmed not far from where I grew up, back in the steel country, when it was still steel country. You can see vestiges of once was industrial America in that movie.
De Niro, Voight, both in
there. It's the movie that made Meryl Streep.
Oh, wow.
It's John Dunze is in it. It's quite a cast. I know people who sang in the choir. A real church choir is singing there at St. Theodosius Church in the movie. Anyway, but it kind of shows a little bit about the immigrant experience and their children, grandchildren of these immigrants. You want to be an American on the one hand, but you may want to hold on. And you may want, you find yourself also practicing in a church which is not as known or understood here, just seems sort of viewed as exotic or almost foreign.
Sure, oh yeah.
And so you perhaps have it a little more privatized to yourself. And you try to, in conversations, minimalize some of the differences or some of the uniquenesses of it. You know, the first description I got of the Orthodox Church, I asked one of my neighbors when I was a boy. And they said to me, well, because I was baptized Roman Catholic, they said, you're a Catholic? And I said, yes. And they said, well, we're kind of a lot like you, except our priests are married, Okay, except our, you know, except our priests are married, and you know, our services are just a little more exotic, and we don't have the Pope. That was my catechism about the Orthodox Church.
Three things.
Until I was in later years of my grade school education, when during the conciliar sort of era, post-Vatican II, the Roman Catholic Church, they taught us that there was great recognition of the Orthodox Church by the Roman Catholic Church as having apostolic succession, valid orders, valid sacraments, and they were as legitimate as we are, except, gosh, we wish they was back under the Pope. You know, it's like it's been reiterated as a teaching from the papacy that if a Roman Catholic attends the divine liturgy of the Orthodox Church, that it fulfills their Sunday Mass obligation. There's few greater endorsements than that. If a Catholic and an Orthodox are getting married, it's actually easier and sometimes preferable if they get married in the Orthodox Church. And they would see it as being married in their own church as long as it's sort of registered or witnessed. So a Catholic can remain in good standing,
right,
without any question being married in an Orthodox church. So, you know, these are kind of endorsements that they seem simple on the surface, but are very meaningful. And give great hope to more substantive union in the future.
They represent progress in the best sort of way.
Now, there are those, when you talk about this council, who feared that it would be a Vatican II, because Vatican II does not have a great reputation among some Catholics and among many Orthodox as well. Not in the principle of trying to embrace or address the modern world, but some of the disasters that came out of it.
Maybe lost some of the disasters, meaning perhaps losing some of the distinctives, because it's sort of a perilous balance, right? You're trying to maintain your identity, and you know that you're a peculiar people, and yet you want to relate. And there are some who think that maybe some fallout from Vatican II is we lost some of our distinctiveness, even in our liturgy and things like that. That no longer that sense of this is a peculiar people.
I'll refrain from some comments on that. I'm too opinionated. But
you, Father Tom, no way.
There's always a difference in what we say on air and off air, isn't there? But this council, there was great hope for it. I'll tell you what happened. As they moved forward, some of these last preliminary agenda-type meetings and stuff, a different feeling emerged. It was not the principles or the directives that people had envisioned how the council was going to take place. It seemed to violate the very spirit that Patriarch Athenagoras, who put this whole movement into moving forward in the church, what his expectations were. So all of a sudden, they produce, might be able to pull it up on your handy computer screen there. I think there were six major positions and papers that were put up. So you have, first of all, you have a content of the agenda. Second of all, you have representation, and then you have the procedure for this council. Okay, all of those issues are issues that everybody would like to discuss, and those papers were put forward. Procedurally, then, two problems happened. One is that there's not going to be a free discussion, and there is not going to be changes, and there are those who say that you cannot alter these documents. Well, this church says, I don't like this. I don't like this. I like to talk about it. Wait a minute. Wasn't this whole council about discussing matters? And who are you to just write something and you think we're just going to rubber stamp it? Where is the conciliarness of this council? Also, the size
was
of delegations.
Was that the reason that the four did
not come? Well, it was one major issue. Second of all, procedurally, it was not proportionally representative to Orthodox population or to numbers of bishops. To the reality of what the church, how the church is. Thirdly, there was a great objection. I mean, proportionally for the bishops, for instance. When you look at Russia, you're going to give them 12 bishops. You're going to give a see that only has a very small population, almost the same delegation. How well? Where is this? What's another thing in the procedures that began to break down? The discussions, the size of the delegations, the ability to edit. Several of the churches had met. Many of the churches had synod meetings in their own lands prior to this, building for this, getting their own positions, shall we say, in line, their own houses. And we began to see that this council was somehow wasn't working. The procedure started breaking down. So there was petitions that was drawn up by several of the churches saying, "Listen, let's delay this council because there's just too many things that aren't working. All right, just these things are just not working out." That was denied. We're going to go forward with this anyway. It had to be moved from Istanbul because of security concerns. And if you notice what's going on in Turkey.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we'll have to pick this up on the other side of the break here with Father Tom Galloway. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Lay representation.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to know our full lineup of shows? Go to breadboxmedia.com. You can read all about our contributors literally from coast to coast. You can also listen to podcasts of shows that you miss. If you've missed part of my conversation here with Father Tom Galloway, just go to breadboxmedia.com, click on the podcast link, go to iTunes, Google Play, Podbean. You can listen after the fact. You can also become friends of your favorite shows. Just check that out again at breadboxmedia.com. Here with my good friend, Father Tom Galloway, here for his monthly visit. Father Tom, an Orthodox priest. We talk a little bit about the recent Orthodox council that met in Crete, some of the controversy beforehand, and what the fruit of this council will be. As he referenced, there were six official advanced documents dealing with everything from the mission of the Orthodox Church, the Orthodox diaspora, the issue of marriage, fasting, autonomy, and relations of the Orthodox Church with the rest of the Christian world. So, Father Tom, were these documents all approved at this council as they stood before the council?
I think, by and large, those who were there did accept the documents as presented. The vast majority of the Orthodox population on planet Earth was not represented at the council. The four churches that did not participate, first and foremost is Russia, which has over half of the Orthodox in the world in it. The Patriarchate of Antioch, one of the oldest apostolic sees, Bulgaria, Patriarchate of Bulgaria, and the Patriarchate of Georgia, not the state, the nation of Georgia.
So your patriarch did not attend?
No, we did not. We have, anyone would like to look at the Antiochian positions on this, I would refer them to antiochian.org. You can find there was a position and a statement why we were not going to attend, sadly, the council, why we were not going to attend it. That is on there. And also the aftermath, our synod met in sort of reaction to the council as well. And that document, which I have a printed copy in front of me, but is also posted there on our website as well, antiochian.org. The marriage, for instance, prior, each of the churches, independent churches, held synod meetings prior to this. Addressing the, what's our take on various papers, what's our take on. And then it began to be emerged once they're there, you're not really going to edit them. Well, that was a very disturbing fact of the churches, because churches took exception.
Hmm.
Both Antioch and Georgia, for instance, did not like the document on marriage. And Georgia, actually, you can also find this on the internet, actually reworded it, or kind of rewrote sections of it and wanted to amend it. In retrospect, I can see why there were objections to it, primarily because they didn't feel it was strong enough. They didn't feel it was a strong enough statement. It wasn't clear enough to faithful. And I think the Georgians, when they rewrote sections of it, and those translations are available, I thought were really on point. But when things like that are not going to be heard.
Mm-hmm. But just and to clarify, I mean, the just like it with the Catholic Church, I mean, the Orthodox will never redefine marriage as being non-gender distinctive. In other words, marriage is by its nature male and female.
If anyone has ever been to an Orthodox wedding or ever read the service of an Orthodox church, interpretations of it in any other way are impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Impossible. But the document was not clear enough. It wasn't a strong enough statement to be made for our faithful. And I think that was a very legitimate concern. That was echoed then when it was brought to the attention by others. They said, you're right. Other churches agreed. Church of Bulgaria did not attend. They were particularly upset with the wording, the document, and the tone that the document on ecumenism took. They began to reiterate some of the objections to other documents once they read them. But the one on ecumenism was the one that set them off. They did not like that at all, and they wanted it to be addressed. And they had concerns they wanted edited. Russia began to have questions about a number of the documents and the entire procedures of how the council was being run. And they chose not to attend. Antioch and Jerusalem have had an interjurisdictional issue between the two of them for 3 years. They've asked the Ecumenical Patriarch. Antioch has asked the Ecumenical Patriarch to help to heal this situation. It's a clear violation. It should be a slam dunk case. It's a clear violation of the canons of the church. And an intrusion by Jerusalem into the territories of Antioch. The Ecumenical Patriarch has yet to address it, and he tells Antioch that we'll talk about it after the council. The council is supposed to open with Divine Liturgy on Pentecost Sunday. And Antioch says, how can we stand with our brothers not being reconciled, not being in communion at liturgy with each other? How is this possible? Let's heal this first. Let's heal this first, then we'll talk about other matters in the council. So, was it a success or a failure? Well, for the institution of the Ecumenical Patriarch, they're very self-satisfied. In the grounds of the Orthodox world, not so much.
Well, you don't have, four of your 14 there. Russia, with such a huge presence, not there. Here's from my very uneducated observation as a Roman Catholic, is that when I see that...
You say, you need a pope.
No. Don't jump ahead of me. Though, I won't lie. That certainly is in my mind. But I think it gives me a feeling of how can we really move toward any meaningful reconciliation of East and West if the East can't even decide who speaks for them or how they can speak together. That's it feels like to me it erodes some hope, I guess. And maybe that was naivete to think, did not realize
what... Well, does the Pope really speak for the Catholic Church? Even Catholic leaders, Catholic bishops around the world, they don't even agree with him. They speak openly the other way. So I think that there, the one thing that the Orthodox had hoped is that we could come together and have common statements that we could jointly make. The one thing the Orthodox will not accept on any terms, okay, there's a spirit within the Orthodox Church that we're, that things are to be done conciliar-wise, not dictated.
Right.
It doesn't matter if it comes from Rome or Constantinople. The laity's exclusion, totally from this council. Women's pretty much exclusion from this council were objections. Because it does, this council to be representative of the church,
sure,
must represent the church.
Mm.
And in that, the Orthodox will tell you, we think Bartholomew, the ecumenical patriarch, studied well, far too well, while he was in Rome. And these types of tactics do not sit well in the Orthodox world. So I think perhaps one of the most laughable moments was the spokesman of the Ecumenical Patriarch at the end of the council says that these documents had passed, mm-hmm, and any decisions we've made are binding on everybody, whether you're here or not. And the Orthodox world laughed.
By the way, we're running it. We got about less than 2 minutes. I did, while we were sitting here, I spinned up our Dial of Catechism wheel, which I do on every show, of course. And we're not going to be able to get into this because it does highlight a difference. And maybe it'll give us a little bit of a sneak preview for next time. But if we get the Dial of Catechism music going here, Ethan, that would be great. I dialed up this paragraph. Like I said, we'll have to shelve this for a future time. But it's all about fecundity. Fecundity, not a word you don't hear often, Father Tom, but about fertility. Fecundity is a good, a gift, and an end of marriage by giving life. Spouses participate in God's fatherhood. Next time, I want to talk a little bit about differences on the issue of contraception between Orthodoxy and Roman Catholic.
All right.
All right. So that, all right, maybe that'll increase listeners or alienate more. We got about 40 seconds. Can you give us a prayer, a blessing?
Sure. We're down. Wow.
Time flies,
doesn't it? Let's say a prayer here from St. Basil the Great. Beginning of the day. Arising from sleep, I thank thee, O Holy Trinity, that for the sake of thy great kindness and long-suffering, thou hast not indignation against me, for I am slothful and sinful. Neither hast thou destroyed me in my transgressions. Thou hast shown me thy customary love towards man, has raised me up as I lay in heedlessness, that I may sing a morning hymn and glorify thy sovereignty. Do thou now enlighten the eyes of my understanding, open my ears to receive thy words, and teach me thy commandments. Help me to do thy will, to hymn thee, to confess thee in my heart, and extol thine all-holy name, of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, now and ever, and unto the ages of ages. Amen.
Thanks, Father Tom. We'll be with you tomorrow by God's grace. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.